Hello, everybody. This is Paul Douglas Boyer. Welcome to the Mad Money Machine Show 155 for Friday, 24 April 2009. It is our 16th anniversary of our wedding, and we have no plans. But coming up on this episode, we will get into the passive investor versus the active investor. That is Dan Solon versus Jim Cramer. I'll tell you why leveraged ETFs are toxic to your wealth. We will get into rehab for the active investor and talk about what does it mean to be an efficient market. We will ask Marilyn Vos Savant about the stock market. And we will turn to Tom Woods for more information about the meltdown. I'll have a cool tool for you for the iPhone, and we will spin our guru roulette wheel. Over at Index Funds Advisors on the web at ifa.com. I think it's one of the best investing... No, it's the best investing site on the internet. And so if you're an investor and you want some information about investing, you need to go and read everything you can read at ifa.com. Take their risk capacity survey. That's the starting point. Benchmark your portfolio against their 20 index portfolios to see how they compare in risk versus return, and then sign up for an account with them. Let them help you manage your financial freedom. Well, did you see CNBC Power Lunch last Friday? Yeah. Dan Solon, who is actually an advisor with IFA.com and the author of the book, The Smartest 401k Book You'll Ever Read, he appeared on Power Lunch, and they asked him, what should we do? And one of the things he said was, one of the things you could do is give us more in Bogle We Trust and much less in Cramer We Trust. You know how they always flash that up on the screen, in Cramer We Trust. Well, give us more in Bogle We Trust, according to Dan Solon. Well, Cramer happened to be within earshot of all this, and he came out and said, in all due respect, the S&P is flat literally for 10 years. That's John Bogle's world. And he went on to compare Bogle's world to his world, in which he claimed credit for advising investors when to get in and out of the markets. And I say, baloney, baloney. And I've got proof because I keep a little mark, a little reminder on my S&P stock chart. Back last July, Cramer said, that's it. That's the bottom in the S&P. And he was right for maybe 3 or 4 days. And then the bottom fell out, as you know. Yes, Cramer has a selective memory when it comes to telling us when he told us to buy and when he told us to sell various stocks and indices and things. So, oh boy, what a game that is, isn't it? To be in this guru business. Ben Stein has an article out at the New York Times talking about these gurus. And let me just pull a little quote up from you. He says, I don't blame Mr. Cramer for trying to act as if he knows the future. That's his gig. But the most that economic seers can do is apply broad, generally acceptable principles to current situations and try to go from there. When I stray far from that, I hope that thoughtful readers will call me into account. So, I agree with Ben Stein on that. I just don't think people can predict the futures, certainly Cramer on picking stocks. And I'm going to get into later something that even more cements my conviction of this. And you'll want to stay through to the end of this show if you can. Let's talk now about these toxic leveraged exchange-traded funds. I've talked in the past about these fun little multiple bearish funds like the SKF and the FAZ. SKF is the inverse 2X financials fund. So when the financials index goes down 1%, this SKF goes up 2% in a day. And it's pretty cool. If you would have bought this thing, this SKF, back at the peak of the financial market, man, it would have gone up and up and up with a caveat. And the caveat is what is important here. I have posted out at the madmoneymachine.com blog the mathematics behind all this, but let me boil it down for you. Let's say that the XLF starts at $10. This, and we're going to use the FAS, which is the 3x multiple of the XLF, and it goes positive. So when the XLF, the financials fund, goes up 1% in a day, this FAS goes up 3x that, 3% in a day. If the XLF were to go up 10% in a day, this FAS goes up 30% in a day. It's fantastic when you're in the money. So let's take a two-day example. XLF goes up 10%. It started out at $10. The next day it is $11, right? Well, and then the second day, though, it goes back down to $10, which is a drop of how much, college students? No, not 10%. From $11 down to $10, it is a 9.09% drop. Okay. We got to do some hard, higher mathematics here to get the understanding behind all this. Now, the 3X fund, though, the FAS, on the first day, when the XLF went up 10%, the 3X fund went up 30%. So you started with, let's just say it started at $10 also to make this easy. The next day, after day one, the FAS would be $13. Great. Well, the second day, however, when the underlying index, XLF, lost 9.09%, how much would FAS lose? Well, it would lose 3x that. What's 3x9.09? It's 27.27%, which takes us down to what? You'd think it would take us down to the same starting point of $10, wouldn't you? That's the toxicity in buying these leveraged funds. There's nothing inherently wrong with the funds, but the toxicity is, instead of going back to $10, that 27.27% drop got you down to $9.45 for a net loss over the 2 days of about 5.5%. So, whereas the underlying index after 2 days was unchanged, the 3X multiple fund lost 5%. Amazing, amazing. And why is this? It's because this is not a cumulative multiplication fund. It is a daily multiplication. And it makes all the difference. And you really have to understand what you're getting into here when you get into these leveraged funds. Now, it is true that if you are on the other side of this, it can work in your favor to a compounded degree. Let's say that instead of going up from the $10 and dropping back down to $10, let's say that the underlying index went up 10% the first day and 10% again the second day. Okay, so you started at $10, it went up to $11, and then it went up to $12.10. For a total gain of how much? Not 20%. We're compounding here, remember? That would be 21% gain on the original $10 after the 2 days. That's the underlying fund. Well, what about the 3X multiplier? The first day, compounding a 10% gain, it went up 30%. which gets us from $10 to $13, right? The second day, same thing. It multiplied by 3 or went up 30%. The $13 went to $16.90. The total gain then is 69%. Whereas the first fund after 2 days went up 21%, this multiplier fund went up 69%. So that is more than the expected 63%. Are you with me? Can you follow me? It's higher math. That's why these things are crazy. And they're not the kind of thing in a market that's going up and down and up and down and is choppy. Oh my gosh, it's not the kind of thing you want to buy and hold. So that is the problem with the leveraged ETFs. And I guess if you're a trader, maybe one of the strategies traders think about when they buy these things is they say, all right, it's $10. I'm going to buy it at $10 and I'm going to set a stop at $9.97. If it happens to trade that low, it's going to knock me out of it and sell it. That way, you know, I'm going to try to catch the bottom and ride this thing up and then sell it at the end of the day. And I bet you there's a lot of traders taking that strategy when they try to trade these leveraged ETFs. And I bet you it doesn't work in the long run. But if you've tried it and you have a system that's absolutely guaranteed to work, let me know. Send me an email, feedback@madmoneymachine.com, or call the voicemail line, which is what? 571-366-7121, I think. Or go to drop.io/madmoneymachine or twitter.com/madmoneymachine. Number of ways to get to me. Let's go to rehab.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back.
Rehab is for the active investor who just can't convince themselves that they need to become a passive investor. And we've gone through the first 3 steps of 12 steps. I'll come back and forth, actually not really going in sequence across the 12 steps in these rehab segments, but I do want to talk about step 4, which is time pickers. And in this section, brought to you by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com, I'm leaning heavily on the work of Mark Hebner in his book Index Funds, the 12-step program for active investors, in which he talks about the efficient market hypothesis. And it simply states that market prices accurately reflect all available information at all times. This leads to the conclusion that it is impossible to consistently beat the market averages. Bachelier stated in 1900 that the expected return of speculation is zero. And most recent studies by folks like Richard Roll indicate that new information is reflected in market prices within 5 to 60 minutes. Within that 60 minutes, there are hundreds or thousands of traders all competing to profit from the information. If you're in charge of $1 billion, a 0.1% annual gain is worth $1 million per year. So consequently, managers of those funds are applying considerable resources to squeeze out every little gain from new information. For this simple reason alone, there is an absence of opportunities for one trader to consistently profit from all the other traders who have access to the same information at the same time. So in short, all of us no more than any one of us, and it is impossible for one person to consistently possess more information than all the other traders combined. So in layman's terms, what is this efficient market hypothesis? It states that market prices are fair, they fully reflect all information, but it doesn't mean that prices are perfect. Some prices may be too high. Some might be too low. There is no reliable way to tell. In an efficient market, investors can't expect to earn above average profits without assuming above average risks. Market efficiency doesn't suggest that investors can't, quote, win, because over any period of time, some investors will beat the market, but the number of investors who do so will be no greater than what is expected by chance. I want to get in more into this efficient market hypothesis on upcoming Mad Money Machine episodes, so stay tuned and listen for this segment brought to you by Index Funds Advisors. Check them out on the web at ifa.com. On the last show, I talked to you about a must-see video from Dimensional Fund Advisors about the what should we do in the markets now? Well, one way to get that is to subscribe to Index Funds Advisors podcast in iTunes, because they have not only the video version of that, which you can download to your iPod or your iPhone, they also have a pure audio version that you can just listen to as you're driving to work. I highly recommend it. Subscribe to the Index Funds Advisors podcast and get that episode, and definitely, 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 definitely listen to that one. So Marilyn Vos Savant has a column called Ask Marilyn. Marilyn. And she's often in Parade magazine. We have the issue that we got from our Washington Post. Wonder how much longer the Washington Post will be in business. Well, one of the questions that she received from James Tarbert of Fruitland, Washington, is this. He said, in a recent column, you wrote that when the price of a stock soars and then plummets, quote, much of that so-called lost money never existed, unquote. But what about all the folks who buy a stock at its high of $100 and then watch it collapse to $1 per share? Where did that money go? We've tried to answer that here on the Mad Money Machine before, haven't we? Where did the money go? Well, here is her answer. And it's so clear, much clearer than I could ever put into words. So I will give it to you. She says, it went into the hands of the sellers. But this real money figure accounts for only a small proportion of the, quote, lost money. When those folks bought the stock at $100, they artificially inflated the net worth of all the shareholders, including the people who bought the stock at $1, $5, and so on. That's because brokerage statements indicate that everyone's stock is worth the last share price multiplied by the number of shares they own. This huge collective amount, derived from the misleading multiple, is the non-existent money that people believe they have lost when a stock tanks. But what if they all had sold the stock at its peak? Wouldn't that make the money real? No, that was never possible. Only the early sellers get the peak price. When sellers start to outnumber buyers, the price drops. And with many would-be sellers, the stock plummets. So shareholders find themselves back at square one asking the same question, where did all the money go? So I thought that was a pretty clear answer. I'm going to talk more later in this episode about forces that would cause a lot of people to sell at once. So stay listening for that segment. Now, I finished reading a book from the library, Tom Woods' Meltdown, which is a quickly written book that tries to explain the situation we are in. And one of the questions that he answers in there is, he talks about shattering these myths about gold. The myth that he puts out there is, there isn't enough gold or silver to facilitate all the transactions of a modern economy. That's the myth, according to Tom Woods. He says, yes, there is enough gold or silver. Since any supply of money is optimal above a certain threshold, the existing supply of gold or silver, combined with whatever additional quantities might be mined in the future, can indeed facilitate transactions. It's an old fallacy that says a given supply of money can support only a limited number of transactions. He said, David Ricardo answered it nearly 200 years ago. This is a quote from David Ricardo now. If the quantity of gold or silver in the world employed as money were exceedingly small or abundantly great, the variation in their quantity would have produced no other effect than to make the commodities for which they were exchanged comparatively dear or cheap. The smaller quantity of money would perform the functions of a circulating medium as well as the larger. So back to Tom Woods, he says, remember that what really happens in an economy that uses money is that goods exchange against other goods. And the exchanges are simply denominated in money, which is gold, silver, whatever. The precious metal is just the intermediary. If there is relatively little of the precious metal to go around, well, prices will be high. But so will wages and incomes. Here we see money's role as the numeraire that establishes exchange rates between all goods in the economy. The numeraire function can be carried out by any supply of a precious metal. This is, in fact, how the American standard of living increased in the 19th century. A relatively constant amount of money supplied, combined with an ever-increasing supply of goods, yielded lower prices. So people could acquire more things, more of the things they wanted, for less money. Let's pull something out of the Mad Money Machine tool crib. You remember I've talked about the Kindle in the past and how, well, I sold my old one, did not buy a new one. One of the things that I was intrigued by on the Kindle, though, was this idea that you could get the Wall Street Journal on the Kindle. I did not do that when I owned my Kindle. I got a sample of one issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Kindle, and I did not like it one bit. First of all, it was difficult to navigate, didn't have the pictures, it wasn't in color, and of course you had to pay money for it. Well, this week's tool fixes all that, but what's even better is you don't need a Kindle. You just need an iPhone, and everybody's got iPhones, right? It's the Wall Street Journal on the iPhone, made available within the past week. Yes, go to the App Store, search for Wall Street Journal or WSJ. Bring up the free application, and you can read articles from the Wall Street Journal in living color, categorized by section, and it puts the Kindle to shame, especially because, like other tools I've given you so far, it's free. Things in life are free. You can keep it for the birds and bees. Now give me money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel, roll the marble, and for the selected guru, give you a little background on their investment philosophy. So here we go. And the winner this time on Mad Money Machine Show 155 is Richard Duncan. Richard Duncan has worked as a financial analyst in Asia for more than 18 years. And he's, according to the back of his book here, he says he's with ABN AMRO Management. I think he's in Singapore, but that's probably a little old. This book that he has written is called The Dollar Crisis. And I'm looking at the revised and updated version from 2004, which is the unfortunate part about this book for me. As I was reading and I was thinking, my gosh, what's happened in the last 5 years? What's happened in the last 5 years? What's happened in the last 5 years? I tried to go out and Google, you know, statistics that he has in this book. But let me try to boil. First of all, I don't necessarily recommend that you read this book. It's a labor of love to try to get through this book. But for me, what was interesting was he made a number of predictions in this book that have come true, and reading it, therefore, was like a mystery thriller, trying to get to the end and see what other predictions that he has that have not yet come true. All right, trying to see through his eyes to see what is going to happen to the dollar. But I think I've learned some things from this book. First of all, one of the things I've learned, you remember a show or two ago when I talked about This idea of what if the United States was on a gold standard and we had to trade our gold to China for their TV sets? Well, we'd run out of gold. And I did get an email from longtime listener Stan, who talked about, no, you won't run out of gold, because what happens is that the acquiring country will receive lots of the gold and thus they'll put it in their bank accounts, and it will cause inflation in China, causing the prices on their goods to go up. Conversely, in the United States, as we run out of gold, run out of credit on our side, we cause deflation. Our prices for our things come down, and the trade imbalance comes back into balance as we buy more things from the United States instead of from China. And that is exactly the thesis that begins in Richard Duncan's book, The Dollar Crisis. He says that central banks originated as repositories of gold created to bail out bankrupt fractional reserve banks. But they continue to morph into active managers, central planners, and meddlers in monetary affairs. These aren't Richard Duncan's words, but that's my translation. He said, when the world was under a gold standard, trade deficits were self-correcting, just like I've talked about. We buy too many TVs from China, our gold gets shipped over there, and when they put it in their banks, they make credit easier on their side, causing inflation on their side, making their products more expensive. Likewise, our gold supply gets lower, credit tighter, deflation on our side, prices fall, things tend to balance out. All because money is hard to counterfeit because it was coupled with gold. Well, the clock ticks. Government intervenes. Money becomes no longer backed by gold. Money becomes easily counterfeited all over the world. Now what happens when we buy TVs? We send them these things called dollars, and their pockets bulge with them. But instead of easing credit on their side, instead of causing inflation on their side, what instead of trading their dollars into the yuan, the Chinese currency, what they do instead is they turn around and they buy things with the dollars they've received from us. They buy things from us with the dollars that we send them for the TVs. Now, what do they buy? Well, a lot of times they'll buy U.S. Treasury bonds. They'll buy a debt from us, which is basically the reverse of that, is we borrow money from China. We're taking the dollars that we sent them and borrowing them back. We'll say we'll pay you some interest on the money that we owe you now, the dollars that we owe you back, which is kind of strange because do they really want the dollars back? No. They want to get rid of the dollars. That's why they're buying the assets. Well, they buy U.S. Treasuries, certainly. They also buy Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac debt. And they buy other things, which I'll get to in a minute. But for most of the dollars we send them to buy stuff they make, we borrow those dollars back from them, and we agree to pay them interest on those borrowed dollars, so we don't experience the tighter credit then, like if we would have under the gold standard. Instead, ironically, credit is easier because we have more dollars. So our products are even more expensive. Are you following me with this? And theirs are relatively cheaper still. So now we're even more encouraged to buy their TVs and not our TVs. And that is why globalization, according to Richard Duncan, makes the consumer price inflation in our country low. So this is a feedback loop. What if we don't need to borrow their dollars? That is, we don't have big government debt. Then they, with their dollars, buy other assets. They might buy corporate bonds, or they might buy equities. Yes, with their dollars, they might invest it in the S&P 500. So you can imagine, as our trade gap gets bigger, as we buy more and more and more and more TVs at cheaper and cheaper prices, and then we keep buying more and more stuff from China, all that dollars comes washing back into the United States looking for something to buy. It buys bonds. Bond prices go up, bond rates go down. And of course, if you've been following it, bond rates are very low at the moment. Some are zero almost. It also causes equities to rise, just like bond prices rose. And boy, have we not seen that. Equity prices over the past 5 years, up until the peak, rose dramatically. Could it be that a large part of that equity rise was due to dollar assets in foreign countries seeking investment? I think so. So there's this macroeconomic factor to why the stock market is going up. There's a monetary factor as to why the stock market is going up, has gone up. And so you get a sense that paying attention to any particular stock is almost pointless because you're awash in this liquidity that's bending all stocks up. I mean, whatever I can possibly buy, I just want to go out and buy it with this, all this money I've got to spend. And so you thought GE was a buy because Cramer said the company looked good? No, what is going on is this is asset inflation. Asset inflation. And the Federal Reserve of the United States is not mandated to control asset inflation, just price inflation. Prices on stuff we buy. And we buy stuff from where? China. And prices on stuff from China have been falling, actually. So when they compute this number, this consumer price index, which is an aggregate of all kinds of things, it includes some of these products we buy. And those prices have been dropping, which makes the CPI seem stable. Hey, the Fed's doing its job. It's keeping consumer prices stable. Well, there's another thing that's going on with China in particular, and that is their currency is pegged to the dollar. So as we print more dollars, they have to print more of their currency also. Several shows ago, I asked, what would it mean to have a concept known as Austrian investing? If I believe the Austrian economists were correct, then what would they say about investing? And I think this has an aspect to it. I think the Austrian investing concept would look at macroeconomic trends in credit bubbles, in asset bubbles like this, and say, okay, over the long term, here is the kind of forces that impact equity and bond prices. And the problem is, and when I got to the end of this book, the end of this mystery, it didn't exactly tell me who shot who. In other words, it didn't lay out for me what's going to happen next. It just simply says the dollar is going to plummet. There's going to be a dollar crisis. And actually, he says in here somewhere that eventually the dollar will collapse and they will have to issue a new currency somewhere. And so what are his solutions? Richard Duncan in The Dollar Crisis says China and other countries need to set a minimum wage for their workers that is higher, so that those workers will create a demand for their own products, making prices in their country rise, helping the trade imbalance. So make TV prices rise, and maybe we'll start buying more TVs in the United States, I guess. He also talks about having a globalized currency. Yes, he does. He says that these SDRs that the IMF has created, he talks about them a little bit, he says we should use those as the global currency somehow. Didn't get into exact specifics, but I think he's acknowledged that he didn't have specifics, but he said we need a global currency. And coupled with the third point of the solution was that for any country that has an excessive trade gap, like us, we import too much from other countries like China, or China, which exports too much relative to other countries, there need to be fines put in place by some global authority in excess of 1%, so that when we import too much, we pay a fine on that. And that should bring the trade back into balance. Something that was able to be done under a gold standard, but is impossible to be done under fiat money that's counterfeited and created out of nothing. Woo! This was hard reading, folks, and I don't know if I got all the essence out of this book that I wanted to get out of it. I think I'm going to have to read some more about monetary effects. There are some authors out at lewrockwell.com and at mises.org that have talked about this book in particular and about monetary events. But congratulations to Richard Duncan. You're the guru on Madman Machine Show 155. I'm so glad you joined me here on the Madman Machine. It's fun to do, even on a beautiful, sunny day like today. It looks like we're going to completely skip over spring this year. You remember I talked about on Planet Boyer, I talked about my golf adventure in 40 degrees. And last Tuesday when it was raining so bad. Well, tomorrow they say it's going to be in the 80s. The next day, the upper 80s. So we're completely skipping spring. We're going straight into summertime. And I can't wait to get outside and enjoy it. So I'm going to sign off the Mad Money Machine for now. Thank you so very much for joining me here. If you enjoy this show or Planet Boyer, tell a friend, would you? I would appreciate it. Send them an email, put it on your Twitter post, put it on your blog. However you communicate with people, tell them you enjoy listening to the Mad Money Machine and or Planet Boyer, and you recommend that they listen to. Thank you so much. This is Paul Douglas Boyer, saying it takes money to make money, and it takes the dollar crisis to make a Mad Money Machine. I will see you next Friday, and in the meantime, join me at Planet Boyer, probably come out next Wednesday. Have a lot of fun on that show, and don't forget to visit the website of Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com. Please do me a favor and do that. And tell them I sent you when you sign up for an account with them. That'll help. Oh, and by the way, I got a Twitter from Garrett T. He says, I fixed my garage door thanks to you, Paul. Thanks! I'll see you next week.